This edition of the Monocle Arts Review was first broadcast on the 1st of October 2015 on Monocle 24. Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. I'm joined today by writer Mark Mason to discuss three books he's chosen. On our bookshelf today, we have Frank Barrett's Treasured Island, Callum Chase's Surviving AI, The Promise and Peril of Artificial Intelligence, and we look back at Wise Guy by Nicholas Pileggi, as this month we celebrate 25 years since the release of the film Goodfellas, which was, of course, based on this book. That's all to come here on the Arts Review on Monocle 24. Welcome to the show, Mark. Let's start with Treasured Island by Frank Barrett, who is by day the Mail on Sunday's travel editor. The book is essentially a kind of literary tour around Britain, looking at the country through works of classic writers from Austen through to Dickens. First of all, what did you make of it?
I loved it. It's one of those honest travel books. I like that because I think Bill Bryson started doing it 20 years ago, and I try and do it in my books as well. That sense of you can still be entertaining about a place without saying it's the best place on earth. So, for instance, in this, Frank Barrett goes to Westminster Abbey, for instance, because of Poets' Corner and all the literary connections there. And they're very, very rude to him. And it costs a lot to get in. And he's very honest about that. And there's another one at one of the National Trust properties that he goes to, where the guard, the officious guy in his uniform, that breed that exists all over the world, never mind Britain, says, you haven't pre-booked your parking. And Barrett says, well, I didn't know I needed to. He says, looks around, there's a virtually empty car park. He says, no, you need to pre-book. I'll see if we can squeeze you in. And all that sort of stuff is very entertaining. Plus, obviously, all the literary stuff is fascinating, the stories about the famous names.
Absolutely. I mean, he's written a number of travel books before. He's even written a guide to kind of real-life locations in children's books. This time he tackles sort of grown-up fiction, I guess you'd call it. How does it work? I mean, is it as much literary criticism as it is a travel guide?
Yeah, what makes it great is that you know you're in the hands of someone who loves this stuff. He obviously is very well read, and he loves his Austen and his Dickens and his Shakespeare and knows the lot. So when he tells you about something, you know that he hasn't just done a quick 5-minute read before he goes there. And he says how he grew up reading this stuff. And then you see how it turns out in reality. Like, everyone knows the vague story of Austen and the story of her novels. But then he goes to see the man he thinks might be the most photographed man in Britain. And it's a man outside one of the properties who, I'm now trying to remember which character it is. It's not Mr. Darcy. I remember thinking this was going to be someone dressed up as Mr. Darcy.
Are we in Bath at this point?
We are, yes. Okay. For the Austen connection. Yeah. And it's one of the other characters. I now very annoyingly can't remember. But it's this guy is stood there in the period costume talking away about, you know, having his photograph taken. And it's just this weird thought that someone 200 years ago wrote her novels that she was so ashamed of writing that she used to write on little scraps of paper. Not ashamed, but she didn't want anyone to know that she was doing it. And she used to write on little scraps of paper. And if anyone came into the room, that meant she could cover it up very quickly.
Interesting.
So something that starts as timidly as that ends up being one of the biggest tourist attractions the area could wish for. Okay. And a guy dressed as one of the characters 200 years later, having his photograph taken with all and sundry.
Amazing. So which were your favourite bits? I mean, which parts of the country does Barrett kind of capture the best and bring to life, I guess?
He goes all over and it's all captures it all brilliantly. I like the surprising stuff, the stuff that makes you think, we all know that everyone loves Austen and everyone's going to have their picture taken with this guy. But then you get something like the revelation that P.G. Wodehouse couldn't stand Charles Dickens.
Right.
And there's a quote from a letter where he writes to a friend. He says, I just can't go. I just don't like the bloke. Don't like his books. And it's really surprising that one great of English, well, you wouldn't call it literature, but English comic literature, doesn't like Charles Dickens. It's, you know, it's really reassuring. And the stuff like the really little the insights into these people's lives, that he goes to Thomas Carlyle's house in Chelsea. And Thomas Carlyle and his wife Jane were both very tricky characters, apparently. And Barrett quotes Samuel Butler, who said it was very good of God to let Carlyle and Mrs. Carlyle marry each other and so make only two people miserable instead of four. So it's not just the great and the nice sort of chocolate box picture of Britain. Gets inside these people's lives and reveals all sorts of wonderful details.
Fantastic. I remember 3 years ago, the British Library actually did a similar exhibition. It was called Writing Britain, and it was a very similar subject. They even looked at Platform 9 3/4 in King's Cross. I was just wondering, why do you think this is such a sort of rich subject for inspiration for writers?
Because these are, when you do a book, when Frank Barrett does his book like this, he knows he's starting with material that people are still buying, or, you know, that people are still buying however many hundreds of thousands of copies of Jane Austen's books 200 years later. You know you're dealing with a subject matter that by definition people are interested in. And what you're doing is sort of going behind the scenes of it and showing us a new side of it. And by the way, the character is Mr. Bennett, I've now remembered. Mr. Darcy, it was Mr. Bennett who has his photo taken.
Fantastic. And when he goes to a new place, is it kind of looking at the history of that place, or is it looking at what it is like today? I mean, how does he address each
place? It's both, and that's what makes it great. And I love that you get sort of three layers of history. For instance, you get Frank Barrett going to Stratford-on-Avon and the Shakespeare stuff, obviously, that's there and that everyone's going to see. And then you go back roughly halfway between now and Shakespeare. You get to Walter Scott, who scratched his name in a penknife into the windowsill at Shakespeare's house. And you think, you know, the great and the good Walter Scott, he wouldn't dare do something. You know, if a 15-year-old did that these days, they'd be a vandal and they'd be arrested. But it's strange to see how these two greats from different eras can interact.
Fantastic. Treasured Island by Frank Barrett is out now, published by AA Publishing. Let's move on now to Surviving AI, The Promise and Peril of Artificial Intelligence. This is by Callum Chase. Now, the title itself kind of holds both optimism and a sort of dire warning about the future of humanity. Which do you think ends up coming out on top? I mean, according to Chase, should we be excited or scared by AI?
Inevitably, whenever you ask a question like that, I'm afraid the answer is both. But I found myself getting scared as I went through it. But then by the end, I started to develop. I'm not so sure. Now, obviously, Chase is the expert in this. He studied it far more than I have. So we've got to take his opinions seriously. But he seems to be far... You know, I have got an amateur interest in this ever since I got into science fiction and Blade Runner, which I had as a kid. I'd never got into science fiction. I thought it was all weird. And, you know, those saddos at school that liked all the, you know, Doctor Who and all that sort of stuff. But now the continued success of Doctor Who shows that science fiction has really got something to it. And there's a brilliant quote at the beginning of this. Chase says that he always thinks that science fiction is philosophy in fancy dress, that the best science fiction asks really important questions, as Blade Runner did, about how do you tell the difference between a human and a machine? And of course, that's what this book's all about, starting off with the Alan Turing stuff about can a machine think and what makes us human. And he quotes, Chase gives a brilliant indication of just how difficult it is to make something that is realistically human. And obviously, humans do it all over the world by breeding. But actually, if you're going to do it artificially, he says the brain, imagine that each inhabitant of New York City had 1,000 pieces of string, which they handed the other ends of those 1,000 pieces of string to 1,000 other inhabitants. And then they sent 200 signals per second down each piece of string. And he's saying that's roughly how the brain works, but the brain does that times 10,000. That's what the brain does, and that's how complicated this thing that we all take for granted, that we're walking around, it's making us do, you know, I'm pointing to that glass on the table now, and all the things that have gone on in my head to make that completely routine thing happen. You try and make a machine that can do that. So he's setting himself up saying how high the barrier is. But all the way through it, he's more and more convinced that it's going to happen sooner than my gut instinct says it can do. He thinks his best guess is that in the second half of this century, 21st century, we will get what they call, the slang is AGI, Artificial General Intelligence, basically something like a Blade Runner machine that is as intelligent as human beings and can function like that. And then he says that it will become a super intelligence, and these are the ones you really have to worry about because these are the ones that can kill their controller and do all the Blade Runner stuff and go on the run and be more intelligent than us. He thinks it will become, that AGI will become a super intelligence within weeks or months rather than years. So It's astonishing. And I think, you know, they famously built, the Japanese a few years ago spent hundreds of millions, not tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars making a robot that could walk. Forget all the intelligence, talking and all that sort of stuff. Just the physical act of walking. And they got it doing a really realistic human walk. But then they put it on a carpet and it couldn't cope with a carpet. It could walk on a hard surface but not a carpet. So there's all that stuff. But then Chase reminds us that since 2005, it's a decade now, the best chess computers have been unbeatable by humans.
Right.
You know, that there are incredible advances happening. And there are now computers that can write a report on a sports match, on an American football match or a baseball match. They can write a report. You just give them the results and they write the report, and you cannot tell whether it's been written by a human or a machine.
That's slightly scary.
There's scary stuff in there, yeah.
Although that might be scary about the writing of sports writers. I mean, Callum Chase has written kind of extensively on AI, and in both fiction and non-fiction texts. I mean, in 2014, he wrote Pandora's Brain, which was a kind of thriller about intelligent machines. And it's obviously been covered, as you said, in film and fiction before a lot. I mean, do you think his writing of fiction brings anything to this kind of piece of non-fiction?
It's a more serious book than I thought. I thought it was going to reference fiction more than it did.
You know,
I mentioned Blade Runner, Philip K. Dick and all his short story stuff, and there's a huge tradition of people involved in artificial intelligence trying to build these things who got into it through science fiction, and you know, the nerdy kids I was talking about who are into that. I thought it was going to reference the fiction more than it did, but nevertheless it's fascinating. You know, the trouble that these machines can get you into. Forget the ones that can do your karate chop and kill their creator and become like Frankenstein's monster. There's been high frequency trading by computers when computers can spot a pattern in the market and they act on it in microseconds. And that has been that was blamed in 2010 for what they called the flash crash on the Dow Jones. There was a massive crash because these computers all started going in the wrong direction very quickly. It can lead to trouble. It's really interesting the role of Google in all this, because of course Google are now so big and can afford to buy lots of these startup companies who are doing this sort of stuff. Just how careful Google are being with it, in that their criterion for investing in one of these companies is what they call the toothbrush test, that they will only invest in something if it's a product that will have relevance to an average person's everyday life once or twice a day. So, you know, there's a lot of serious thinking going on about this, about how it's approached. But if the worst predictions come true, and Chase quotes some of the other writers who think, you know, this could lead to lots of trouble very soon, it could be very scary. Yeah.
Interesting. And is it accessible for a layperson? I mean, I know he's kind of studied it extensively, but is it kind of accessible for someone like you?
Absolutely. That's precisely why I looked forward to reading it so much. As I said, I'd got this amateur interest in it, wondering whether Blade Runner was going to come true. And that's the aim of the book, is to explain it to people who are averagely intelligent and have got an interest in it and want to know what the geeks are saying.
And so we've been talking about Surviving AI, The Promise and Peril of Artificial Intelligence by Callum Chase, which is out now and published by 3Cs. Mark, your final choice on today's book review is Wise Guy by Nicholas Pileggi. This was, of course, the story behind the blockbuster gangster film Goodfellas, which came out a long 25 years ago. Why did you decide that it was time to take another look at this?
Well, precisely that, because I read the other day that it was 25 years ago, and all my friends have said, oh my God, that makes me feel old. Goodfellas really 25 years ago? The book's 30 years old, came out in 85. The film obviously made in 1990. And I just had a look. I'd never read the book, and there'd been a copy sitting on my shelf for ages. And I thought, well, actually, let's get around to it. So I didn't make myself watch the film. Let's be honest, it's one of the best films ever. It's not a chore to watch. But reading the book was incredible, of just how realistic the film was. All of the famous scenes in the film are based on stuff that happened. You know, the stuff when they're in prison and they've got this very cushy life for themselves in prison, and the big Paulie is slicing the garlic with the tiny little razor blade. That's real. The thing about the postman right at the beginning of the film, when Henry Hill, the real-life gangster who's the subject of the film and the book and who basically wrote the book, Nicholas Pileggi, a huge chunks of the book are just Pileggi transcribing what Hill has told him. Right at the beginning of his life, he's been bunking off to go and work for this gangster at the age of 14, 15. And his school have written to his parents. And the letter, and so that's how his parents find out. And then the mafia, but I say the mafia, it's one of those words. Yeah, it's used in the book. The Godfather famously didn't use the word mafia, but it's used in Goodfellas. The gangster gets the postman who delivers Henry Hill's post and intimidates him and says, if you get any letters from the school for this kid's parents, you don't deliver them, otherwise your head's going in the oven. And that really, all the famous scenes are in there, with the exception of possibly the most famous film, am I funny here? Where Joe Pesci is saying, I amuse you? Am I funny? How am I funny? What? How am I? I nearly said one of the words you're not allowed to say. And that was actually based on Joe Pesci himself, who'd been working in a restaurant as a kid, and a gangster had been in there. And Joe Pesci had said, oh, you're really funny, just, you know, to it as a compliment. And the gangster took offence. Wow, didn't actually threaten to shoot him, but, you know.
I mean, I was going to ask about that, because one thing the film is remembered for is its kind of violence and that sense of tension you get whenever Joe Pesci's character, Tommy DeVito, comes on screen. I mean, is that in the novel as well, or is that kind of added by Martin Scorsese?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's possibly the second most famous Joe Pesci scene is the one where he shoots the kid who's bringing them the drinks as they're playing cards, shoots him in the foot. He says, dance my drink over here, and shoots him in the foot. And then the kid tells him, uses one of the words you're not allowed to use, and tells him what he wants to go and do to himself, and so Pesci kills him, and that did happen.
Right.
It's all in there, and it's what's fascinating is earlier in the summer when I was on, we talked about the Craze book, because the new Craze film is out, the sort of British equivalent of how these absolute psychopaths, and they were, they loved violence for its own sake, as well as what the rewards it could bring them. They were worshipped by the local community because they were all put very similar to East End of London and this part of New York where Henry Hill grew up. Lots of poverty around back in the 40s and 50s. And it was a route out of it. So if someone got out of it, albeit through crime, they were worshipped locally. And also that thing about them making everyone safe. There's a scene in the book, or an episode in the book, real life story, where a woman is about to be assaulted by a guy who's followed her back to her house. And all the guys on the street have seen it. And just as this guy's about to go and assault the woman, they all pile onto him, take him up to the roof, throw him off the roof and kill him, which is a very extreme way of dealing with it, but shows you one of the reasons they were respected in the community.
Right. We should just clarify. I mean, so is this book, is it a true life story or is it fiction?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. It's basically Henry Hill's autobiography, who at that point in 1985, when it was written, had had a life in the mafia, got to nearly 40 and was put into the witness protection program as a reward for testifying against all his mafia colleagues. So yeah, it's absolutely the true story, and that's what makes then watching the film afterwards makes it incredible. You think this is Scorsese; he's going to tell a good story. He's going to egg us on a bit, and he's going to over egg the pudding. That was the metaphor I was looking for. But no, it's all absolutely true, and that's what makes it even more of a stunning film once you've read the book. I really would recommend people to read the book.
Absolutely. And finally, I mean, do you think it kind of the book still stands up in the 21st century? I mean, is it still relevant, or is it a little bit of a kind of historical interest piece by this point?
I think it's still relevant. I think the fact that people still watch Goodfellas, they still watch The Godfather. That new film about the Craze that we mentioned that's out this year, it's doing fantastic. You know, people are raving about Tom Hardy's performance in that. There's something fascinating about criminals. Maybe it's because in a different world, we'd all just want to go and live their life and do what they do without any consequences. It's still absolutely relevant, still a brilliant read.
Wise Guy is out now, published by Simon & Schuster. And I'm afraid that brings us to the end of today's show. Mark Mason, thank you very much for joining us today on The Arts Review. You've been listening to The Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. My producer was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again at the same time tomorrow for this week's film review. But for now, thanks for listening and goodbye.